Hi there. This is a recording of a teaching session which occurred on June 14th, 1997, here at Holden Village. This session is entitled The Similarities and Differences Between the Ghanaian Community and the USA Community. And the presenter is Sister Rosina Ampa. So let's join Sister Rosina in just a moment here.
From the Order of St. Helena. And this is a continuation of the series we've been dealing with about community. And we have progressed from stages up to, I think this is the fifth session. And today I'm going to be trying to compare and contrast the community I grew up in Ghana with the community I live in, which I've already given each one on a separate tape. So if people miss that session, they're available for people to listen. So today I will start by saying that as human beings, we all struggle and try to live harmoniously with each other, no matter where it is. We may do it in small segments or we may do it in larger segments, but the idea is we are all trying to fulfill what we've been using, the theme, no longer strangers, trying to be with each other and to live with each other. And various cultures do it very differently. And in my culture, as I explained, living in community entails more than just the little community where you live in. And when I was talking specifically about that culture, I explained how a child's involvement or social life starts as soon as the child is given a name on the eighth day. Your social life begins then, because the mother going somewhere will just leave the baby with an aunt or with a grandmother or with a neighbor. And so the child begins to, by the time the child's eyes will open well to identify, the child is not identifying just one person or two people, but the whole community is involved in that child's raising. And it's very different from this society, where the community entails just the nuclear family. And so people are very protective. Also, one thing that I noticed that is very different is how children are involved in the raising of their own siblings. Here, I think children, young children, are not trusted in a way that they may dump the small child, or they may do something terrible to the child, which is very different from my culture. They try to let the older children be part of the parenting, which builds the child before they get to that age of being parents themselves, how to care for children in the community. And so sometimes they would tie the baby. I was going to bring a picture, which I forgot. They would tie the baby on the back of the older brother or sister. And the child would take care of the little one, and when the baby is crying, the child will bring the baby home. Sometimes the kid may be reckless and will lose the cloth, and the baby may fall. But the mother will pick the baby, and traditionally, I don't know how the elders knew that. They will say, just touch the place that the baby falls and then touch it with the baby, because the baby is going to be falling all along as the baby grows. And so the earth and the baby are the same, so you don't have to beat the other child for doing that. And the typical example of that was when I was a kid, my senior sister, not that she didn't do that on purpose. She did that on purpose because they did something wrong, and my dad was watching them from the window when they were doing it. And so that, and I was on the back of the elder one, and the next one, they were standing there and they broke on a green pineapple from its stalk. And Dad called from the window and said, put it back. And they didn't know anybody was watching, so they were scared. And instead of Dad realizing that my mother has tied me on the back of the senior sister, Dad started coming down the stairs. And for her to run faster, she undid the cloth and let me down, dropped me and started running. And so, unfortunately, we lived in a place called Jerusalem Hill, and it's very, very hilly, very steep hill. And so I had to roll with a cloth around me all the way to the bushes down. And so Dad, instead of chasing after me, was still angry that she did that, so was chasing after the senior sister. And my mother almost killed him. Killed him for doing that. And you could imagine when my mother finally, and they couldn't find me, and I was screaming down the hill somewhere. So my mother went and got the other woman in the house, and they came, just using a cutlass and just looking through the patch to come and find me, because my mouth was just telling them where I was, down deep, in the valley. So my mother came down and got me, and when they picked me was when everything was so, they were terrified because I was, bloody all over. And not knowing, I had a little cut right underneath my eye from the tall grass when I was going down. And you can imagine, my mother almost killed my dad for that. And so that's the kind, but that didn't stop my mother from tying me on the back of my sisters. That's the only way the child becomes stronger. And the elder sister also learns how to take care of the little ones. So at certain age, the mother or the father may not be home, but they will be able to care for the siblings, which are which is very, very different from the community I have encountered here.
How does the youngest child get trained? By a neighbor, perhaps?
Well, they get trained by the family. The whole village. I mean, that's why it takes the whole community to raise that child. The parents will be teaching them, giving them instructions home, but it's not only the parents who are emphasizing what the morale is or is good for the community to grow into.
But I was thinking the youngest child doesn't have a younger one to have strapped on her back. So do the neighbors use...
You mean this country or the in Ghana?
Youngest, mm-hmm. In your country, you mm-hmm. were the youngest.
Uh-huh.
And who strapped anybody on your back so that you would learn parenting?
As you grow up, they don't do it automatically. You have to come to a certain age, like 4 or 5 or 6, so that when they put that child on your back, it's not too heavy or burden on you. And so... by the time you get to 5, if your parents have stopped producing, the neighbors who are around, I mean, that's why it's so important, because the community is a community of all. Not just, or sometimes they will say, they will bring the child if the mother is too busy in the house. If you have an, older child who is there doing, later they'll say, oh, can I put the baby on her back?
So a first child would go on a last child, neighbor's last child.
Yes, we all, they all try, or sometimes the children themselves. You see, it creates this community, open community for the children. And I've watched the new couple that came in, I've forgotten their name. They came with a neighbor, that young girl, the little girl is Sarah. And I've watched that young girl who looks like an Asian, And I think the Asian community is the same. Most of the third world countries treat the children the same. She has been carrying that little girl back and forth on her side, you know, just playing, and sometimes I will stop and chit-chat with the baby, but she has been the one who has been carrying that child.
They probably brought her to be the babysitter.
Well, not really. The parents have been carrying the baby, but the girl will go and ask. And so the child, I think, they live close by from the way the child knows this other girl. So I was carrying the baby yesterday. I got the baby from the father. And I was carrying the baby. And I was playing with Sarah, and Sarah was laughing. The other girl came and then called the name, and immediately she went like this. And this told me something, that they live close together.
I think they might be an adoptive family.
Okay. I don't know, but I'm just saying that the child knows the older one and the next one. And, you know, because the child has been carrying her, immediately when she called the name, the kid went like this from my arm. And so I said, oh, Sarah, you want to go to your sister? So I gave the girl back, and the older said, oh, she is my friend. So that's what I do. And I told her, but she still can be your sister. And she said, yes. So that's another way of, you know, relating and teaching that is very different. Yes?
But one result I noticed of that in Africa was that babies don't spend a lot of time down laying by themselves. They're almost always in someone's arms.
Exactly. Exactly. And what that does for the child, it gives the child security. Take, for example, a child who has been left in a cot most of the time. They are very insecure. The world is not safe for them. Try this. They've been now realizing that, so they're now taking the older people they put away in nursing homes to go to hospitals and handle the babies who are stillborn and sometimes need somebody to play with them and cuddle them. And in Bellevue's hospital, I think it was in hospital, a journal for the doctors, that those children are growing better because of the love of the cuddling and handling. Human beings, we live here for 9 months. You are very close and enfold. Then suddenly you find yourself in a world where you are abandoned in a little box, and when you cry, nobody comes. You start to think that the place you've entered is not safe. So it's psychologically, it starts with that tender age. Or somebody will come and stick a tube in your mouth, feeding bottle, and then disappear. You want the warmth and the cuddling. And that's why I think most African countries, the children are very secure. They feel very much a part of the community. And they really relate to adults in a very different way. And so it's a kind of system. Another part of it is we don't have, you know, social security or anything, but the community is your security.
And it's interesting that in our so-called advanced civilization here in this country, we're just now, through research and investigation, discovering how important touch is, which comes naturally in other countries.
Yeah.
And we putting the baby in the box, as you say. Mm-hmm. Babies have been shown to not thrive if they're not given special attention and touched and cuddled and so on. And interesting that we're just now discovering this.
Well, I think a part of it may be, you know, the development of industrial community, and people were moving so much. But on the other hand, it could have been done still, because people live in big houses where you have so many people, but people do not even know their next door neighbor. And it baffles me that, you know, sometimes I'll go as a priest, somebody will call in a big complex, and you go in there and you try to locate the person, and the people living there do not know the person. And it really baffles me, coming from a culture where most of the people will either know you or your grandparents or your great-grandparents, and they always shock me. When I have been away like this, and I'll go back home and I'll put on my native clothes and I'll be, you know, I dress up just like any Ghanaian, and I'll be walking in the street and an old person will stop me and ask me, do you belong to such and such a family? And I will say yes, and they say, boy, these people, you cannot steal them. They all look alike. I mean, it's so funny. And I will stop and I will say, all right, you see, and I will laugh. And I look like my mother's duplicate. At the same time, I look like my father because they looked alike. And so people will pick me up from my father's background as well as from my mother's background. And so you don't have a way of going behind the scene and doing something wrong. Because this is the other thing about it, that knowing the people around you is not only security for you, but it helps people not to do bad things, because they know whose child is this, who is going this way, and when they see a stranger, they always ask. And one thing also in my culture that I'm going to be talk basically next week, Monday, as a whole session, is one can be shamed for not treating a stranger well. It's very, very important, because the proverb in the culture is a stranger is like a child. They may have the biggest eyes in the world, but they don't see. Another part is a stranger does not break a rule. So they take a guest very seriously, or a stranger in town. And so people will go out of their way to really help you or welcome you. In a way that sometimes, you know, people coming from the Western culture will sort of shrug and back off that, you know, why is this person? Because it's a culture that when you are doing something, everybody is expecting that they are expecting something in return, because that's the society one lives in. But in my culture, they are not expecting anything back but to take care of you so that you will not go back and disgrace the culture. That I was in this culture, in this country, so-and-so, and I was really standard, nobody cared. That is a real taboo. I mean, your family will scold you if they hear you did something like that. And so it's part of the whole culture that people get to know people. So when you see somebody who is not part of the community that you haven't seen for a while, you walk to that person, you greet the person, you say, I'm so-and-so, who are you? And, you know, are you visiting or have you moved here? And so you get to know the person, and that's how you make friends with the people, and they are included in the community. It's very, very different than the community I live here. Even though it's a religious community, we strive to be, the part of the community's ethos is hospitality. And be kind to, you know, people who really do not have enough. So we have a lot of charitable work that we do. But at the same time, I can see the difference, because it's a small body of people who have moved and live together as religious community and have centered their lives upon this, that this is what we intentionally want to do. And so we put every effort into it to do that. Another thing that I notice is very different from my culture is that when you are cooking, they always advise you, even as a child, don't count only the people in the house to cook the food. You never know the stranger who is on the road coming and may be hungry when they arrive. So you always cook more than, and I haven't gotten over that. So every time I cook, it's my turn to cook. There's a lot of leftover in the fridge. But here, people always try to count heads. And I remember my first struggle with that when I first came into the community. I asked them, why do you ask people if they will eat this before you do it? They said, well, we don't want to, waste the food. And I said, but in case somebody else comes in and the person is hungry and you are eating, what do you do? And so I used to tease that, and now I understand why people sit, and then have their newspapers like this. So I don't see you. Or when they travel on the subway or in the bus, they have other things to entertain them. They will be reading their book. And so I don't have to meet your eyes and talk to you and get weary to know who you are. I said, now I understand. You don't count heads. And so I had a real problem with that. People will ask me, do you want to go out to eat? And I would say no. And it took them a while to finally ask me, why do you always reject when we want to take you out? I said, the very fact that you ask me, do I want to, I don't. I said, if you really want to give me, invite me, say, come, let's go. Don't ask me, do I want to eat it? And if you ask me, you don't want to give me, that's why you're asking me. And they couldn't understand why. And so we had this explanation and dialogue going in until finally they started saying, now we know what you want. Come, let's go. And I'll get up and I'll run after them. And we will go and we will have such a wonderful time. So after now, they still tease me. And I said, no, you do it and you offer it to the person. That's your hospitality. The person have every right to say, I'm not hungry, thank you. You can put it there, another person may come who is hungry and will eat it. Food never go waste there, because you can always give it to a neighbor's child. You can call children in to come eat. So food is never wasted. And I have witnessed so many food being thrown away in a garbage while other people are hungry because they don't know how to offer it to another person to really. And I've watched people dish into the garbage in New York City. And I cry tears when I see that. That somebody bought this with money, couldn't eat it, instead of offering it to somebody else, they dump it in this garbage, and here are other people dishing through the garbage and eating it. When we have parties at school, when I was in school in New York, sometimes there will be food left over. And what I would do is, wait, I'm going to get it to people, so I'll parcel it, and as I'm walking on the street going home, I'll see the homeless. And I'll just give it to them. I said, are you hungry? Do you want food? And I said, I have, food here. And I mean, this is good food, sandwiches, sometimes beef, sometimes turkey. But what would they have done to it? Dump them in the garbage. So this, the society has gotten too big to a point that it has become me and mine instead of us. And I believe this whole universe was given to us as stewards to really take care of it. And so as I go around working with young people, I always say if you get the young people, you are really getting up the whole community because they are growing up to come. And I talk as I'm talking with young people, trying to share with them the importance of really trying to live with each other. Another thing I have learned that has been very important for me that I wish my culture will really imitate from this country is the way the country sometimes has structured its finances, that people who do not have jobs will have at least some money to care for themselves. They call it something. What is it called? I'm talking in this country. Not welfare. It's not welfare. Not unemployed, thank you. Unemployment. Because at least it gives them a little something to survive on. And until a certain time, that in the interim, to look for a job. And I think that's one thing that, you know, since I've been here, has really attracted me. That is something that it would be wonderful if my country would be able to do that. Because at least you are not just gone and don't know what your next meal is going to come from. They will give you unemployment to a certain point. But in my country, do not have that system. On the other hand, because of the family and the extended family, people will not go and, you know, get stuck. And I believe that's why maybe they do not do that. But I think it's a very important aspect of this country. Yes.
I was wondering what the effect of urbanization has been on families in Africa. And I asked that. I was in Zimbabwe 3 years ago, and it was spent time with a family in Harare, both parents working, and it seemed that it was reflecting more of a nuclear family that you would find in the United States, the stresses of a working mother who was trying to fulfill those traditional roles and work. And it saddened me because it seemed like they had been cut off more from that extended family that was back in the village. And that as these cities continue to grow, that the children are going to miss out on that. And I was wondering if you see that happening in other places.
Yes, I have witnessed, as I said, what it comes with industrialization. And it's not, you know, that may be just one country and the people's preference. But when I was working, I worked a lot when I was home. And when I was working, I took the children, when I know I'm not going to be home, to my aunt or to their grandparents or to my senior sister, so that they are not really cut off completely. And during certain time of the year, when schools are vacated, they are all gone to be with the village, so that they have that kind of relationship. Because that's what was done for me. My dad was a school master and later became the school principal. So we were transferred a lot. And I was going to focus on this actual Monday to really talk how the whole country becomes a community. And I'll move just even from this nuclear of an area. And what happens is when we move to another place, we find families within the families there. And so we are not just a schoolmaster transferred with his family, like my mother and then the rest of us. But the people in the and I remember very clearly when the chief of the town, when we moved to DSO, the chief of the town came to the school one morning to visit my dad. And what he said was that, my family is your family. This whole town is yours. Whatever help you need, let us know. And every Saturday, different people will come to the mission house and ask us, the children, to go to farm to get food for us. Not to buy food, but to get food, because we've just moved there and we don't have farms. And so each family will take us to different farms and give us food, until the following year my father was able to make a garden. And so people will come and get us to go to farm. So you see, you move from your community, but you have another community. When you move to a larger area like Accra, the household you live in is huge enough. That's another nuclear family. You see, the people in that compound, you know, and they are proud to say we have grandchildren coming to rear, even though they are different tribes. They take you in. As I said, the culture is bent on hospitality, and you can be shamed if you are not. And so when you move into another community. It may not be your own tribal community, but you've moved into another community unless you as a person refuse and reject it.
Our African daughter works as a, is in Namibia. Mm-hmm. And when my husband went to visit her, her husband's, I think two sisters were living with them, and one baby, and then another child from another family. And that really made it possible for both, they were both working. And this also was helpful for those particular women because they were needed a place to be. But it's a very different feeling. He stayed there a week, and he said it took him 2 or 3 days to figure out who lived in that household. Because he'd go to bed and someone was sitting there watching TV and it was a neighbor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You put yourself into the family to rear it. And typical example is the Africans in this country. When they gather together, you know that these are Africans. You don't know where they are from. Once they come to United States, it doesn't matter what African country, they are family. And when they come together to do things, you will hear them calling sister, brother. But one may come from East Africa and one may come from West Africa. But the very fact that they are Africans, they come together as a community. And I was in Georgia and I've been there and I'm always struggling. I want to find some Africans here. And so one day, the priest called me and said, oh, we are baptizing a baby from Nigeria. Would you come and help us, you know, be part of the baptism? And so I said, oh, yeah, I would love to do because I want to meet this family. So I went down, and to my surprise, the whole place was filled with different Africans. The church was full. And as soon as I walked in, each one started smiling at me because I wore my African cloth. And when we finished the service, it's like I'm back home. Everybody wanted me, you know. And they said, oh, we are having a dance this evening. Will you be able to come? I said, I have arthritis. I don't drive anymore. They said, oh, we will come and pick you up. Sure enough, they came and picked me up. And since then, they've been coming to the convent when we have activities. They will show up. Or sometimes they will come and pick me, take me home. Say, let's go eat African food. But most of them are Nigerians. Two are from Liberia. We have some from Kenya. There's only one from Ghana, and I'm a Ghanaian. But it doesn't matter. We are just, you know, and when I was coming here, one took time to make what we call home gravels, it's little chips, and brought it to the convent so that I would travel with it. That's community. I don't have to come from the same town, the same father or mother, but the very fact that we are all the same and we live in this same kind of system. So once we are here, even though we are from there, we just come together as a community. But it has its implication, as I say, you know. Sometimes people become dependency or dependent on other people instead of trying to struggle to become who they are and their own being. They know that there is a family there that will support when they don't get to where they are supposed to go. And that's the other side. I was saying that, you know, it has its good side and it also has its bad side, just like everything else. And sometimes you get family members who would have pulled themselves together and will not do it because the family will support them. because the community support them. And sometimes you get frustrated that, you know, I'm pulling my weight. Why are you not pulling your weight? So you need to do something about it. And still they don't understand it. They will think that because you don't want to help. And here, because of the other system, that people have to really struggle to do what they need to do by themselves, they are always struggling and pulling and moving ahead. So you see, I said I'm going to compare and some of these things that both communities have, like the community I live here. We all struggle to pull our weight and do the best we can to contribute to the welfare of the whole community. Yes, at home, I have some sisters that I'm always angry with because I know that they can do better than what they are doing. But because the whole community is part and parcel of each other, they just do the little they can. And I get very upset with that. And I say, you know, you have a lot of potentials in you that you can really pull this out and do this, but you are not doing it because we all are pitching in and doing it.
Don't they feel the shame of the family?
Well, you, as I said, you can do it, but sometimes you have people who will say, you know, because you don't want to do it or because you don't want to help me, that's why you are saying this, but this is all I can do. I mean, what do? Do you abandon them to fall by the roadside, or do you continue to support them? And I think that's a struggle we always go through as the way we live our life in community. I will stop here and see if people have questions on their mind, what I've said so far, or if people have something to contribute to what I've said.
What is the source of punishment if people do things that shame the community?
Because of the way the system is, for example, there are some things that the government will punish, like somebody who may kill somebody. It's always the government. Okay. If it happens in a tribal area that the person did not kill somebody, but the person has done something damaging, the tribal chief will take that up. And the chief will sit in, like, you know, traditional court and see what the punishment is for the person. Whether the person has to really compensate through money or compensate through a lot of things. So people try to face justice and peace in the culture. But the nuclear family, sometimes you will get the head of the house to really do a kind of what they call adults get spanking too. And if you want to take that tears out for people to see that you get spanked, it's your problem. But they will do it. They will call you in and really slash you with their mouth. And it's not just one person. The heads of the house will do that. And so they correct people so that you don't take for granted that you can just go ahead and do anything you want. So, yes.
Do you find it hard to be between the cultures?
Yeah, sometimes it's hard. It's very difficult for me because there are times I want to hold people and shake them and say, you know, you can do this better, just do it right, because you are being selfish, you are self-centered. What about all these people? And there are times I go home and I'm also very upset and want to shake people and say, look, you can pull your weight, you know, other people are doing it, you know, why don't you do this? So living in two cultures is very hard.
How often do you get back?
4 years. Every 4 years I go home. But I write a lot, and then sometimes I call once a month and check in with what's going on. Mm-hmm.
I recall being, I was the oldest of three girls, and I recall being in charge of looking after my little sister.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought many times, and shaking my head, because I was not that trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I had been her, I just wouldn't have trusted me to be that careful. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, my next sister, I think, was nicer.
Mm-hmm.
She was. So.
But they still trusted you, right?
Yeah, she did. You know, they let us go out on our own. And,
mm-hmm.
But I couldn't be bothered with my little sister. I'm just horrified thinking about that.
She survived.
She was on my own, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She survived.
My sister was the least of my friends.
But at least the important part is that the parents really trusted you. And I think it's something that is, it gives you another way of thinking, you know, being able to be responsible.
I think the other people
at
in
every
the
age.
In area there, we lived in an apartment in Oslo, Norway,
mm-hmm.
and there was more of that feeling of all the people right around there that mm-hmm. looked after people, and they would tell your mother if you did something wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think you more than you thought.
I think so.
Exactly.
I
mm-hmm.
quickly hear about how the this little girl forgot to curtsy to this neighbor down the street, and
mm-hmm.
that was bad news, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We're noisy in front of a neighbor who was taking a nap, you know,
mm-hmm.
every day at a certain time. And, you know, they would always hear about that. So we of course, had been looking out for
mm-hmm.
people who were sort of like, we didn't like them, so
mm-hmm.
track of us.
It's true. People used to, you know, not only correct you when you do something bad around your parents, but the neighbors used to do that. And I've heard that a lot in this country, that people used to do that. That people, you know, in the street will stop you and correct you when you are doing something bad. But then as the country got bigger and bigger, it became something like, don't you dare talk to my child. And so that's some of the breakdown that, you know, started all this happening. For people to protect themselves, they would rather watch your son doing or daughter doing something bad, got hurt, instead of saying, you know, don't do that.
But our school mm-hmm. operated like that when I was teaching. I mean, every teacher was responsible for every child.
Yes,
in
exactly.
And mm-hmm. you couldn't ignore us because another teacher, you know, that child mm-hmm. class, which I thought was a good way to have it.
I think we need to go back to that. You have your hand.
I have a question regarding, mm-hmm. I mean, with the strong sense of community
mm-hmm.
among not only families, tribes, I mean, and there are so many layers,
mm-hmm.
levels of, mm-hmm. of community. I mean, for example, your cloister, or not, I mean, your
nuclear family, then the tribe, then
so
the clan.
How do you, when you have tribes practicing
mm-hmm.
What you describe,
mm-hmm.
how do you account for all the conflict in Africa, Zaire and all these other countries that are fighting each other? Is that a political, purely political? And if so, why hasn't the sense of community overcome that?
Let me tell you some of the historical background with that. Part of it has been the conquerors, the people who colonized the places. Most of the fault has been theirs. They don't want to own them, but it's their fault. When the tribal people were living there, each tribe knew the land and the places where the line draws. This belongs to this tribe. This belongs to this clan. This belongs to the, and they respected that. The colonizers went in and then started claiming the area for themselves and then building boundaries where they do not belong. And just moving boundaries to areas. And then suddenly, they said, these people have independence, so they abandon everything and leave the place. And then they turned back. But because of what has happened through the interim years, and other people have moved and have bought these places and have, you know, they call it their own, they won't give it up easily. And then the conflict starts. It starts like little, and it takes just a little fire to burn a whole forest. And instead of sitting down and talking and dealing with it, some of these people have been tapped into the Western army. Also, the idea that people who live there taught them with the aggressive way of taking things, with power and guns, and they will resolve to that.
You don't like him killing.
Yeah, and take it.
Yeah.
And so it's very devastating. And the only thing, to tell you the truth, that has saved Ghanaian culture and is still saving it is the traditional chiefs. I was showing you the video the other time. They are very powerful in Ghana. And the government cannot do anything without the traditional chiefs. And they have their own, they call it the House of Chiefs, and the president is the Ashanti King, because he holds a big chunk of the part of Ghana. And then the chief from my tribe is the linguist, because he's very sharp with his mouth and head. He can think on his feet, just like that. And so when there is a conflict, these chiefs try to solve it even before it gets out of hand. And so when the coup happened in Ghana, if it hasn't been for those traditional chiefs, it would have been bloody. And we don't have anywhere to go. But you see, the traditional chiefs also have warriors. They are not part of the government soldiers. So we have soldiers and we have warriors who used to be the keepers of the country when we didn't have this colonization, and they are still there. And so when there is a conflict going on, all the traditional chiefs need to do is to sound the drum and call them. They will be ready for battle in a minute. So you have two warriors or two armies, keepers of the country, that are ready to sacrifice their lives anytime, and they are both very skillful. One may have this powerful tool, guns and bombs, the others have the skill of the country and how they used to move through the bush. And so when you know you have that kind of system in place and you respect it, things go very well. And I think that has been our savior, because you have more than 100 different tribes living in Ghana. More than 100. And so you have, like, they call it here dialect, but they are not dialect, they are languages, they are written. And you move from about 10, 15 miles, you are speaking a different language. So English is the second language in the country, in Ghana. And so most of the areas, we are home, but we communicate with English because I cannot speak the other person's language, you know. And so, but that doesn't really deter you to be a stranger. That's what is most important, that this country speaks one language. Only recently that I think Spanish is, you know, spoken a lot in other areas, and they still can't come together. And can you imagine 100 different languages? You don't understand them. But still they come together because they have this bond of we all came from one ancestor. And so we have to be with each other. So that's the part that solves these kind of problems, that you have this system in place.
And what's going to solve the problem between the tribes?
The Hutus and the Tutsis.
Yeah, the Tutsis, whatever.
Well, at the moment, I think they are trying talk to them to come to consensus, to see how they can...
They
being the Tutsis and the Hutus. That they
the
can...
of each group.
Yes. To come together to talk, to see and realize that they are all part and parcel of each other. They've lived there all these years. And if they kill each other, the other cannot just survive by itself. And so I think, you know, they've come to a ceasefire for a while with the other nations being there. And most of the African nations, the army is in there still. And nobody knows when they move out what's going to happen. But at the moment, they are talking to them, the ECOWAS, talking to them how they will be able to sort of solve this problem and see, you know, how they can really divide the land and the places and really live around each other. So the same thing is in Liberia.
So the hope is in the African aspect of things rather than the
exactly.
governmental
exactly.
establishment.
Exactly, exactly. Because first of all, it was the same government structure that went wrong. If they had had the system, Ghanaians have that, they have chiefs on every segment, I think it would not have come to be that brutal.
You mentioned the colonial thing, and I've mm-hmm. read people say that one of the problems was that, and you've heard this, I'm sure, that the Tutsis mm-hmm. were favored.
Mm-hmm.
They were made the most
yep.
favored. They were built up
yep. mm-hmm.
to be more important
mm-hmm.
by the colonial.
And power. Most of the areas of power was given to them. And so when they left, the same thing happened in South Africa. That's what happened there.
This colonization is primarily British.
It's
I'm very fuzzy on political history.
And that's okay. That's okay. It started for, and I will tell areas where I know, especially. I think in Rwanda, it may have been the French. It may have been the French because I think they were responsible most of the time for this, and so I think it may have been. Yeah,
a lot of Germans were.
I was going to say in Ghana, the Portuguese were the first to land there. They landed there 1452. So that's when the first mass was said there. So Ghana got the Christianity before it came to America. Columba was there in Ghana before Columba came here. And when you go to Elmina Castle, it was called, if you want to check in the World Encyclopedia about history, check it, Elmina da Costa, because it was in Portuguese. And it was called Elmina da Costa. If you read it, it will tell you a little bit about Ghana. And now when the then it moved to the Danes, it moved to the Swedes, it moved from hand to hand until the British came in the 17th century. And that time it has moved, and all that time it created war between the colonizers themselves. Because they will be firing, when we were watching the video, you saw all the cannonballs around the castle. That's what they used to protect their interests. So they will be firing at the other people coming in. So there was always war, but the war was between the colonizers and the others who want to come to colonize the place until they will conquer and then another group will take over. A small country like Ghana, the other day we looked into there, and I don't know whether it's the old map or not, but they've taken the same problem. They've taken part of Ghana and called it Togoland. And it's sitting in Ghana, but they put a border there, and now it's called Togoland. And so Ghana is about 92,000 square miles because of the boundaries that they put in places where it shouldn't be. And I think it's the new one that I have seen, I think in one of the books I was reading, I think it was 142,000 square miles.
So that in essence, the country was divided.
it's still
several countries depending upon the conqueror.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And so they put the Togoland, they speak French. And a small country like Ghana have 40 forts on its coast. 40 castles on its coast. Can you see the damage that was done to that country? And when I tell people that about 60 to 65% of the slaves that were taken came through that port of Ghana, they don't believe it. And I said, look into your histories. Read about 1,000 to 1,800. It's called African History, but then it's had by Basel, and it says from 1,000 to 1,800, or 1,800 to 1,000, or something like that. And it tells you all about the history and the way they conquered that small country and the people that were taken from there. And so you think about all this, and if it hasn't been for the these tribal leaders that have formed that, you know, bulk as a group, you can imagine how we could have killed each other when we got independence. Because boundaries have been put where they don't belong. And now, once it's set like that and it has its own independence, are you going to go and say, give me this? Upper Volta used to be part of Ghana. Now it's not anymore part of Ghana. It's called Burkina Faso because it was cut and it's now French. So if you see the part of Ghana cut from here, cut from there, and you look at it and it's so small sitting there, but it's because of the colonizers. They called that place Gold Coast because there was a lot of gold discovered from that place. Ivory Coast is very small sitting there, but it's part of the whole area, but now it's Ivory Coast because there were so many elephants in that area, and ivory was very popular in that part. And so you see, they have to cut all these apart and give it names from what they got from there.
So you have basically the African designations, and then colonizers superimposed other boundaries.
Yes.
On those.
Yes, and I call it the quilt. Now you look at Africa, it looks like a quilt because it's been cut this way and that way and it's divided. You know, and the idea is divide and conquer.
Then we have the further confusing issue of all the countries that we learned that were in Africa have changed their names, and now some of them are going back.
Exactly. You see,
it's a poor Westerner.
But you see, that's the point of it, because most of the names they are going back to is what they used to be called. And now the colonizers will come in and give a name that, because of what they discovered there, they think that place should be called. And then when they leave and people get their independence, because they've been researching into the history, they want to go back into their historical name. Ghana is a very, very ancient country. When you read the history of Ghana, in the ancient time, Ghana has been in existence around, 1,500 years BC. And they used to trade scholars with Egypt. And they used to do a lot of medicine and mathematics in Timbuktu, ancient Timbuktu. When you read about that history, you will know how many scholars were produced from that small country, Ghana. And so it doesn't surprise me that we have lots and lots of doctors and lawyers and magistrates from Ghana, because it's always been that way. It's a very ancient country. But because of war, they kept moving toward where they are now. And so when they got their independence, the best thing to do is to go back to their old name, Ghana. And so when you say Ghana, people will say Ghana, Ghana. And I would say Gold Coast. They say, oh, because people have known that place as Gold Coast. And so it's very confusing what, you know, the same thing happened in South Africa. Look at how many people have to die before apartheid gets dismantled because of British fault. It was British fault.
And then South Africa,
It was the British fault, because the same thing, when they were there, they lifted up the Afrikaners. And when they were leaving, they left the power in their hands. Instead of giving it to the whole country, they left it in the hands of the Afrikaners. And when I'm trying to sometimes use images and explain to people, recently I was very upset about our system we were using and working, even in a community, and people didn't understand why I was upset about it. And I said, let me tell you again, because sometimes people in the West do not get this, you know, idea until it's too late. I said, now you've elected four leaders because we want to change the system of having one leader in our community. Now, you've elected four leaders, you have three positions, you want to divide it, you don't appoint anyone to the position until you've been able to divide it into four. But they couldn't understand that. They have to appoint three to the positions and leave the extra one hanging and later divide the job. And I said, what do you think the other person feels? But you see, sometimes people don't put themselves in the shoes of another person to really think and say, what I'm doing here, is it going to get effect on the other person? And if you really do that, you really stop to think before you do it. When British was moving from South Africa, if they had thought about it that we have, you know, this many people, black and white, in the country, even though the black group is the majority of this country, if we leave the power with them, we really leave these people handicapped. Okay, if we give it to the white people, we've given it to a small segment of the community. How would the 75% feel? So why don't we really elect a body of all the group here and hand the power over to? It never occurred to them that the Africans are going to take that power and use it wrongly. They didn't dream about that. And look what it has happened, and how many people have to die. And now they are living peacefully with each other. That's the other thing about it. Look when they reversed it. They are struggling, but they are trying hard to live with each other.
Would you explain to me what the Afrikaners are? Is this a tribal group? Is it an ethnic group or what?
No, as far as I know and as far as history is concerned, they are the part of the group that came in also searching for gold, just like this country was discovered. And they came and the natives welcomed them. And so they sort of have married, and you know they have group they call colored.
Yeah.
Okay.
They are the mix.
They are the ones who have moved and married other racial groups. But the group that have stayed intact as white are the Africans.
They have a Dutch.
Dutch
background.
Afrikaans language is very common.
So they were the part of the explorers.
The invaders.
Yes.
Yeah.
I won't even call them invaders, because the Boer War, when the Boer War was fought, I think they said that was the time they actually conquered the natives because of the same way guns and cannons. But then they lived together. They lived together.
I hope so, because I'm Dutch, and I hate to think of my ancestors going in and doing what the British did. And and the Americans in other areas.
So I think the whole history of, you know, breaking the community has been really very hard and difficult on all of us as human beings. And I think as we have the theme for this, you know, summer, we are no longer strangers. I think we are not rehashing this to make each other angry or feeling guilty or feeling bad about it. I think we are rehashing this so that we can learn that, you know, we all can live together with each other and be happy. The earth is so big and huge that when we share it, we all will have a peace if we want to do that. That it doesn't have to, you know, we don't have to claim it for one person to have a whole chunk, whereas the other person won't have any. So I hope we are no longer strangers. We are trying to live as a community and hand and legs and nose and eyes of each other so that we can point each other toward the center, which is God. And the further away we move away from God. And the closer we come together as one unit and one family, I think we get closer to God, because God created us as a family.
It's like the way we are. I mean, God's in the middle. If we're out here, far away from God, we're farther away from each other. And the closer we
get to the center, And I drew that. I drew that on the board the first day I started. And then I put us as human beings around the circle. And I used the same thing that I was so happy when I came in and walked into this unbroken circle. That's God in the center there. And we individual as a group. And I think officially our time is up. It's 12. In 5 minutes they will ring the bell for lunch. And thank you all for coming. Thank you.